Empower Radio presents Out of the Fog. Join intuitive guide and spiritual teacher Karen Hager for lively, positive conversation with light workers, healers, and dynamic wisdom keepers. Get ready for inspiration and connection. This is Out of the Fog on Empower Radio. Here's your host, Karen Hager.
Hello and welcome to Out of the Fog. I'm Karen Hager. Each week at this time, we gather for a spiritual conversation and enlightening guests. I want to spark your spirit and ignite your soul. I want to get you moving from stuck to unstuck, out of fear, and into love. And I'm glad you're here. Time and distance are no barrier to energy, and that means that no matter when you're listening, no matter how you found us, you're here for a reason. And I hope something you hear in the next hour lights you up and helps you move forward. Things change so quickly, don't they? Life feels sometimes like it's speeding up. And sometimes it seems like there's nothing to hang on to that gives us something stable, a foundation, as we move through our spiritual journey. Well, my guest on today's show is the Reverend Dr. Alexander Riegel. He believes that the essential spiritual truths that were discovered by mystic figures long ago, that those truths remain unchanged, and that we desperately need to tap into that wisdom now, to return to the mystic, as he puts it, to help guide us during these times of change. The Reverend Dr. Alexander Riegel has more than 20 years of experience in liberal religious ministry. He holds both a Master's of Divinity and a Master's of Theology from Harvard Divinity School, as well as a Doctorate of Ministry from Andover Newton Theological School. Dr. Riegel is certified in Enneagram Studies and Mediation, and he's trained in conflict management and organizational communication theory. His spiritual journey is interspiritual in nature, grounded in the mystical and contemplative teachings of Hinduism, Buddhism, Christianity, and Sufism. Alex is the founder of Return to the Mystic and the Mystic Poet Circle, both of which he directs as local and online spiritual communities. You can find out more about Alex and his work at returntothemystic.org. Alex, welcome to Out of the Fog.
Great. It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm stuck on that word mystic because I think it means different things to different people. And I'm wondering, when you say return to the mystic, how are you using the word mystic?
That's a great question. It is a term that's rather ambiguous in today's world. Typically, I think when people talk about the mystic, they're talking about the sense of the unknown, maybe unknowable, and the different ways and approaches people have to try to figure out what's unknowable. But when we talk about return to the mystic in the sense that I use it, we're talking about what is mystical in a different way. We're talking really about the contemplative traditions that are the foundation of the core teachings of the world's different various religions. So if we were to talk about mysticism from the point of view of Hinduism, what we're really talking about are those ancient Hindu yogis who laid the foundations of the spiritual teachings of the Rig Veda and the Upanishads. And when we talk about Buddhism, we're talking about the Buddhist monks and nuns who kept the contemplative tradition alive and still going today. When we refer to Christianity in mysticism, we're really referring to the Christian contemplatives who a few hundred years after Jesus were involved in the Alexandrian Mystery School in Alexandria, Africa, and were trying to find union with God through contemplative method. Or again, to touch upon Sufism, you know, those Sufi teachers who have been with us for centuries, who again, through spiritual methodology, are trying to seek union with the divine through contemplation. So mystic, really, as I use it, is about those contemplative traditions that in their inception were mystical at their core, but turned into contemplative traditions with established methodologies for helping us have a relationship with the divine.
And your connection with this is so powerful that you've founded a center. And that center is Return to the Mystic, a center for interspiritual study and practice. interspiritual is also kind of a sort of a squishy term, and yet what you're showing me here is that it's founded on these basic teachings.
Right. I think interspiritual is it's a fairly new term on the spiritual landscape. It's different than interfaith. So when we talk about interfaith, we're talking about the capacity of the world's different religions to tolerate and respect each other and work together, essentially, in rough terms. When we talk about interspiritual, we're talking about something a little different and a little more specific. And I happened upon this term through the work of the late Brother Wayne Teasdale. And he actually coined the term, as best I can tell. And what Wayne meant by interspiritual was something more akin to this. It's the ability or the capacity to stand within one's own religious tradition and yet not only honor the practices and the virtues that other religious traditions bring to the table, but to intentionally take on the practices and the teachings of those other traditions and integrate them into one's own spiritual journey. So, for instance, let's say we have a Christian practitioner. And for the Christian practitioner, of course, the central message is the path of Jesus is unconditional love or agape. And so that's one of the central teachings and hopefully one of the central experiences that a Christian would have in his or her spiritual practice. But it's very important, especially in today's world where the world religions are encountering each other more and more intimately, to be able to look at Buddhism, for instance, and honor the teaching around compassion and honor the contemplative practices that focus on mental states and how to overcome those in an attempt to achieve spiritual experience. Learn from these, take on a practice, think about the role of compassion versus unconditional love. Begin to integrate this into one's own spiritual journey without sacrificing one's original identity. And one can look at the different world religions and see there, for instance, the identification of one's essential self with the divine that Hinduism teaches, whatever the case may be, and really take seriously the teachings and the virtues and the methodologies of each one of these religions and bring them into the lived experience of one's own spiritual journey. And I really think that's the way forward in today's modern landscape.
I agree with you. There's that idea that seeking the divine, seeking greater opening understanding requires a generous approach instead of that very narrow approach where you stay within these lines, right? Here's the tradition. We have these things. Don't you look at those other people doing that other thing. You stay here and do these things and you'll be fine. That often leads people to feel so confined that they shut down completely and stop asking the questions, stop seeking the divine in their lives.
I agree. You know, I think that it has the effect of sort of walling one's own tradition off from the others, which is really a problem set because it limits one's capacity for spiritual exploration and experience. It also sets us apart from others, which leads to inevitable conflict. So what's really required here is a dose of, I'm going to steal a word from Brother Martin, who is a Christian monk in an interspiritual ashram in southern India that I go to. Brother Martin has a phrase that he likes to throw out called doctrinal humility. And so for one to take on the interspiritual, I would say, life or spiritual life or discipline in today's modern world, doctrinal humility is in order, because it's very hard to stand within one's own tradition with the utter conviction that I have the corner on truth with a capital T and genuinely engage these other traditions. So some humility around doctrine and my particular religion's place in the grand scheme is required if we're going to have an authentic engagement with these other traditions.
Do you feel, Alex, that we naturally tend to reach toward the divine, that there's something in us almost factory installed that encourages us to reach out, to seek that mystical experience, to seek that way of knowing the unknowable?
I absolutely do. I love that factory installed reference that you made. That's fantastic. I do think that the way the creation is designed includes within every human being that spark of the divine. And, of course, that's a debatable point in today's world, but my belief is that it's there. And that spark of the divine is an aspect of the self that knows at the very core of our being that there's more to life than the egoic self can deliver to us. And so I think we have within us this intuitive knowing that happens on a very deep level beneath the level of the ego that is hard to put into words and even sometimes hard to touch through feeling states, but it's just there in a very subtle, pervasive way that calls us to an experience of transcendence. You know, there was this book written about 10 years ago, and I can't quite remember the authors of the book, but it was called Why God Won't Go Away. You know, and in that book, we had a couple of neurologists looking at what it is about the construct of the human mind that makes transcendence seem to be something for which we always hunger and thirst. And I would recommend that to the listeners to pick up that small and easy readable book. And they do a pretty good job of talking about how we are indeed hardwired for transcendence. There's another book I'll recommend to people while I'm at it. It's called The Innate Capacity. And The Innate Capacity gets to this very thing you're asking about. It's a very well done, rather academic work, but readable work that talks about this very thing. We have this innate capacity or innate nature that is separate from the ego and keeps us tethered to the ground of being, which is God, of course, or keeps us aware of the sense we have that there's a transcendent piece of our nature. And we long for an experience of that and a fulfillment of that.
And often I think, at least in my work, as I connect with people as a teacher and as someone who is working with people one-on-one who are going through transition, I connect with people sometime where they feel that hunger, they feel that drive, they feel that desire to connect, and yet they don't feel there's anything in their framework that speaks to them. With the return to the mystic center, are you trying to provide an outlet for people who are looking for a way to explore?
Wow, that's a really good question. You know, what I'm trying to do is reawaken modern-day people to the awareness that there's no need to recreate the wheel. People are understandably frustrated with religion today, and you often hear this phrase, I'm spiritual but not religious, which I interpret to mean there is within me this sense of otherness or transcendence or a desire for a connection with the ground of being, and I feel it, and it's meaningful to me, but I don't think the religious institutions in today's world are delivering me the means to fulfill this intuition I have. And so people are saying, I'm spiritual, I have this intuition, I have this longing, I have this desire, I'd like it to be met, but I'm not religious because there's nothing in the religious landscape today that really helps me understand this and actually develop a relationship and a methodology that will take me down the spiritual road in a fulfilling way. And I think the reason for this is because these experiences that the initial mystics slash contemplatives had. And when we talk about this, we're talking about, you know, the experience of samadhi of the ancient Hindu yogis or the kingdom of heaven of Jesus, whatever the case may be. These experiences that lead to these states of consciousness where we realize that not only is there a divine element within us, but that when we come in contact with that divine element, we already inhabit the sacred as a field of view. These experiences are not easy to replicate. And so if you look at the origins of every religious tradition, The origin of every religious tradition is mystical. When Jesus had the experience of the kingdom of heaven in the here and now, he had reached a state of consciousness where he was able to look out on the world and see that he already inhabited the sacred. That's the good news. Or when the Hindu yogis had this experience of recognizing that their essence was identical with the divine, you know, they realized myself and everything about me is already sacred. So these mystical experiences that these people had and then began to talk about were very appealing to followers. And so what would the followers do? Well, the followers wanted to replicate the experience. The followers of Jesus wanted to inhabit the kingdom. The followers of the Hindu yogis wanted to have an experience of self-realization where they knew my essence was the same as the divine. So they developed these communities around these people. And these communities were initially structured to support these figures and to develop the structures in place to keep the teaching and the methodologies that would help lead us to the same states of consciousness that they had. But they're very difficult to duplicate. And what happened over time is that the capacity, I think, for people to duplicate these experiences that these initial figures in the world religions had fell away. And as these capacities fell away, what happened? Well, what you have left when the mystical experience is no longer possible within the tradition itself, the tradition has this influx of well-intended egoically people who try to keep the tradition alive. But because that mystical experience is lost and the capacity for it has atrophied, I would say, because it's a difficult thing to recreate, the religions end up focusing not on those initial mystical experiences, but instead on the teachings that were originally the container in which these experiences would happen. But when you focus on the container and you've lost the inner experience, religion quickly dissolves into a matter of belief and right thinking. And I think that's what's happened with almost every religious tradition on the face of the planet today, is that the initial mystical experience that those great figures had, that people tried to duplicate, we've lost the capacity for them, and the religious structures that built up around them to actually keep those capacities alive have basically fallen into a pretty feeble replication of the teachings and belief systems that developed around these figures. So when somebody looks at a religious institution today, and they're looking to get some kind of teaching or experience where the sense of transcendence can be affirmed and encouraged, what they end up is engaging institutions that will give them a sacred text full of words and ideas, and out of that sacred text, they'll develop certain belief systems that become a creed, and that creed is the gateway into the religious system, but never the mystical and the creed do meet. See, and this is the problem. So what I'm trying to do with Return to the Mystic is to really reawaken those original teachings that you see in the New Testament, in the Upanishads, in the Buddhist Dhammapada, in the teachings of the Sufi mystics, where they really do give us a roadmap that if we follow the roadmap and employ the spiritual methodologies that they name there in exquisite detail, we can, in fact, have these wonderful transcendent experiences that confirm our intuition about who we are and the nature of the universe. How's that for a pretty long-winded answer to your question?
I think that's wonderful. I don't think that's long-winded at all. And you know, you're making me think about how in these atrophied traditions, atrophy is a tremendously powerful way to describe that. It also feels to me to be true that those who should be the wisdom keepers for the tradition, those who should be passing down that knowledge to the people who come after them, those who are doing the teaching and the preaching and the leading, because they have not been grounded themselves in that foundational mystical experience, they're unable to teach it to the people who come after them, and we get farther and farther away from that essential mystery that is at the base of all of this, no matter what label you put on it.
I think that's right. And in the way you describe it, I think it's perfect, because this is the loss of the capacity for these mystical experiences, not due to malintent. It's due to the fact that, A, these states are hard to duplicate, and B, because they're hard to duplicate, the loss of knowledge on how to do it. And so it's really a sort of, through the generations, an increasing innocent naivete that causes people to lose an understanding that was originally there. And what do people do? Well, the leaders can only lead from what they know. And if there's a sort of this innocent naivete that is in place now, and that leads us to a position where we cannot replicate the experiences because we no longer know, then everybody's doing the best they can, but all we really have is a paper tiger. You know, sort of like the structure of, but not the real thing. But the thing about it is that those methodologies and those descriptions of those states really are still very available to us in those sacred texts. And that's the thing that Return of the Mystic is about. If we really get into the sacred texts, these descriptions of these sacred states of being and the spiritual methodologies that lead us to them are alive and well. And that's really the focus of my work in Return of the Mystic.
I love it. It feels to me, from looking at the website, and Alex's website is returntothemystic.org, that you're creating a place where people can get access in a culturally contemporary way to these foundational teachings to help them move forward. There are not a lot of other resources out there like that. When I want to read my own tradition as I identify as Christian, when I want to read about Christian mystics, I'm reading Hildegard of Bingen, I'm reading Julian of Norwich. Those aren't contemporary to me, not written in, although I can understand it, I don't connect with that. I don't hook into it the way I do a more contemporary teaching.
Well, I think, you've really nailed it. And to the extent that I bring a gift to my work, it is a capacity that I've developed over, you know, a couple of decades now of reading these mystics and doing ministry with people and listening to the way people approach spirituality today. I'm able to sort of take my understanding of the very text and figures that you mentioned was a great example, and reinterpret what they're saying for today's spiritual aspirant. And I think that that's really my role in Return to the Mystic. I'm not inventing anything new. I'm not, delivering Dr. Riegel's version of so-and-so. We get right into the mystical texts themselves. For instance, we just finished reading The Cloud of Unknowing, which is this anonymous medieval Christian text on the psychodynamics of spiritual experience. And boy, it was thick reading, but we had a fantastic conversation about it, because I was able to say to people, when we reached a point of stuckness, here's what's really going on in this text, and if you can see it in this light, the whole thing can click for you. And it really worked. And so that's really why I developed the center, is because what we really need to feed our spiritual hunger are these original texts where the map is laid out and the descriptions are there. And we have to have somebody who can interpret these for today's seekers. And that's what I'm trying to do. Hildegard of Bingen is great. John of the Cross is great. You know, Teresa of Avila is great. But when you're talking to people who work 40, 50, 60 hours a week and are trying to raise a family and maybe have 2 or 3 hours a week to take on the spiritual pursuit, you can't say to them, you know, here's John of the Cross, go read that and you'll be all set for your spiritual journey. You have to digest it for them and deliver it to them in a way that they can connect with to keep them engaged in the path and to keep them moving. And so that's really my role in Return to the Mystic. There's nothing new going on here. I'm sort of the interpreter for the modern ear, I think.
And it's not about dumbing it down. It feels to me like it's more about teasing out the essence. Part of that mystical experience to me is seeking that place where you get down to what is absolutely essential. It is this. This is the essential thing. So you're not talking, I don't think, about the Cliff Notes version of the Cloud of Unknowing. Although I have to say, Alex, in my own spiritual education, I picked that book up and thought, okay, Cloud of Unknowing, got to read this. Everybody reads it. I didn't get very far because it was like a cloud to me. And I thought, okay. And that kind of experience makes people think, makes seekers think, this is not for me. I don't understand this stuff. There's something in me that is not the same as what these great teachers taught, these great experiencers and expressors of the mystic, what they experienced. And yet my personal sense is that the truth is that that lives in all of us. There is that essential connection between us and them.
Right. Boy, you really nailed it again. You're very good at this. Oh, I love talking to you.
Thank you. This is something I'm passionate about, because that atrophy that you're talking about, you know, when you lie in bed, when you're not using your spiritual muscles, pretty soon you try to get out of bed. It's time. You need that for whatever reason, or you want it, and you fall on the floor. And it's in keeping those spiritual muscles alive. I'm a big proponent of daily spiritual practice, but it's in keeping those muscles alive. And we do that through reading, through engaging our minds, engaging our hearts. And so I have a lot of passion about this topic.
Yeah, I hear that. And it's fantastic. And the Cloud of Unknowing, if I can just return to that for a minute. So it's this text that originates from an unknown source. And it is, in my opinion, the most exquisite teaching on the psychodynamics of mystical experience that the Christian tradition offers, and it's fantastic. The problem is, as you referenced, boy, you pick up that book, and A, it's in medieval language, and B, it's using metaphors that we don't use anymore to talk about a relationship with the divine, and good heavens, it's almost like reading a foreign language that you've never studied. So what I'm able to do with the Cloud of Unknowing, because of my background and my own spiritual journey and experience, is to get into that in a very deep way and say to myself, so what's really going on here that's going to be relevant to a modern spiritual seeker? And I could turn to the groups that I work with and I can say, okay, here's the cloud in one sentence. The Cloud of Unknowing is about emptying the egoic centers of all objects so that we are in a receptive state to experience a movement of grace where God shows up for us. And you write that on a board and you have people look at that for a bit and talk about the meaning of that. And people can at least get a sense of what that means. And then you bring in sort of the modern language we have for talking about the very same thing. So you basically say, you know, as a follow-up to that, what's going on in the cloud is that the author of the Cloud of Unknowing is telling us, empty the thinking center, still the emotions, and quiet the body so that there are no objects of perception in your awareness, and hold that space from a place of love for as long as you can. And if you can get still enough and empty enough, you will begin to recognize within yourself the subtle movements of the spiritual. Well, bingo, they got that. They get that. It's not that it's easy to apply that just because they've heard it, but at least there's sort of this linguistic roadmap now that a modern person can understand, which will keep them attached to the teaching and maybe encourage them to get further into it. And the beauty about this is that's really what's going on with all the mystical teachings. Because then we can get into the Upanishads, right? And we read the Upanishads. And the Upanishads have every so often these wonderful statements about how to get empty. And in the Buddhist literature, these wonderful statements about how to get empty. And in the Sufi literature, the wonderful statements about how to get empty. And when you've read enough of these together as a group, people start making the connections. Aha! So when the Upanishads say this, they're basically saying the same thing the author of the Cloud said, right? Which is what Kabir Hominsky writes about in Living Presence. Bingo, you got it. And that's the beauty of the work I do with Return to the Mystic, man, when those light bulbs go off with people, that they begin to see all these connections between all these mystical contemplative teachings, then I know that they're getting the message and that they've touched something that's going to feed their spiritual journey.
Wonderful.
And that's when I feel most fulfilled.
You are listening to Out of the Fog with Karen Hager. My guest is Dr. Alex Riegel. His website is returntothemystic.org. We'll be right back after this.
I'm home, and I love it. I'm home where I belong. I'm home, and I love it. I'm home where I belong.
It's always nice to come home, but these days, many Americans are at risk of foreclosure and losing their homes. Fortunately, help is available. Making Home Affordable is a free program from the U.S. government that has already helped over 1 million struggling homeowners, and we want to help you.
I'm home, I'm home, and I love it. I'm home, I'm home.
Find out now what your options are. Go to makinghomeaffordable.gov or call 1-888-995-HOPE. The sooner you act, the better chance we can help you.
I'm home, I'm home, where I belong.
Brought to you by the U.S. Treasury, HUD, and the Ad Council.
This week's episode, Danger at the Old Well.
Last one to the old well, the rotten egg.
Ha-ha, I win. Whoa! Ah!
Sassy! Johnny fell down the well.
I'm wet.
What, Sassy? You know where Mr. Gunderson keeps his rope? Go get it, girl. What? You'd rather use this time to set people straight about shelter pet adoption?
I'm cold.
People shouldn't be afraid to adopt from a shelter? Because shelter pets are screened for sound, health, and temperament?
I'm wet and cold!
Sassy, what about Johnny? What? Let Johnny sit in the well until he learns to be more self-reliant? Sassy!
What'd he say?
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember, adopt!
Have you ever lost a cat? And have you ever wanted to get your cat back after you lost it?
Hi there, I'm Andrew Hoffman. I went on this website called InventNow.org. Then I decided to make an invention of my own. It's called the Lost Cat Magnet Invention. So you can get your cat back after you lost it. Just turn it on, and lost cats stick to it. That's a good cat. If your cat was hiding up in a tree, it won't be up a tree anymore. It will be stuck to the lost cat magnet. And sometimes they fly toward you in the air. Just listen to one satisfied cat. See? That's proof. You should go to the InventNow.org website too. But just remember one thing. Don't do a lost cat magnet.
Anything's possible. Keep thinking. Get started on your own inventions or just play some games at InventNow.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, the National Inventors Hall of Fame Foundation, and the Ad Council.
And now back to Out of the Fog with Karen Hager on Empower Radio, empowerradio.com.
Welcome back to Out of the Fog. I'm Karen Hager. My guest is the Reverend Dr. Alexander Riegel, and he is the founder of the Return to the Mystic Center. You can get more information about Alex and his work at returntothemystic.org. And if you've got a comment or a question about today's show, if you'd like to find out who's coming up in the next few weeks on Out of the Fog, you can always get that information at karenhager.com, and you can connect with me through the website. I'd love to know how you feel about what you're hearing today. How are you taking your quest for the divine, your desire to grow on your spiritual journey? What are you doing about that right now in your daily life? You can connect with me through my website, karenhager.com. Alex, I was thinking about an interview that I heard. I heard just a little snippet of it before I came to the studio, and they were talking about how because science is so much more a part of our lives now than it was, say, when Julian of Norwich was writing, that the language that we use, the way our brains work, is different. We are tuned into the language of science. And yet that makes it really changes then the language that we use to talk about the divine, to talk about our spirituality. It shifts the framework to be essentially quite different than it would have been for those who were contemporaries, let's say, of John of the Cross. One of the ways that you work with the language that we use to talk about the divine is through poetry. And I'm wondering if you'd like to say a little bit about the Mystic Poet Circle and how that feeds into this discussion that we're having.
Sure, yes. Thank you for asking about that. You know, I love the Mystic Poets because they're exquisite practitioners of poetic imagination. And it's through poetic imagination that these poets speak to that intuitive sense we have of our deeper being and our place in the greater scheme of things. And it's important to have this access point into the spiritual because, as we were talking about a few minutes ago, not everybody's going to sit down and slog their way through the cloud of unknowing, regardless how important that text is, even with my help sometimes, because it's just too difficult. But if you can pick up a Rumi or a Hafez or a St. Catherine or a Rabia and read how they use poetic imagination to talk about the very same things, then you've got an access point into the spiritual that I think almost anybody in today's world can engage. I often say to people that the Mystic Poets are the perfect entryway into the spiritual for those who are shunning traditional religion today, even though they're still spiritual. And so it gives us a way of touching that. The thing about the Mystic Poets is that poetry touches the intuition, which is a very subjective experience for us. And in today's world, which is, as you've mentioned, dominated by science and technology and what have you, you know, all of those fields that are based on logic, which is all about proving things, there's a taboo of subjectivity today. If you can't prove it through logic or you can't demonstrate it through science or what have you, or even if it's just not pragmatic, subjective claims about my own experience or my own way of knowing really take a second seat. And that's really unfortunate because when we're talking about the spiritual, we're talking first and foremost about subjective experience. So the poets give us a way into the spiritual through intuition, through poetic imagination, where we have these subjective experiences that can resonate with the poems. And once you've read a few poems by Rumi or Hafez that hook you, and they got you, and they are a wellspring of teaching about the sacred and the divine.
And sometimes they are, it's an illusion, isn't it? But sometimes they're bite-sized. They are small enough to post on Facebook, and yet chewy and delightful enough that you could sit in meditation on one of these verses for years and not get to the end of it.
Literally for years, just a single stanza or two, you know. And they are bite-sized, but they're much deeper. I mean, they're bite-sized and they're fantastic because through poetic imagination, they touch our intuition, and that alone is beautiful. But when you understand the spiritual background or context out of which they're writing, the depth of the Mystic Poets is far greater than hardly anybody imagines. You know, can I just share with you a little excerpt from a Rumi poem? That's my favorite Rumi poem, just to highlight this.
Yes, please.
You know, he's got this great poem called This We Have Now. And actually, if your listeners are interested, Coleman Barks does a beautiful job of reading this poem, and you can find videos of it online. But the poem goes like this. This we have now is not imagination. This is not grief or joy, not a judging state or an elation or a sadness. Those come and go. This is the presence that doesn't. It's dawn, Husam, here in the splendor of coral inside the friend, the simple truth of what Halaj said. What else could human beings want? When grapes turn to wine, they're wanting this. When the night sky pours by, it's really a crowd of beggars, and they all want some of this. And here's the important stanza I want to talk about. This that we are now created the body cell by cell, like bees building a honeycomb. The body and the universe grew from this, not this from the universe and the human body. Well, the stanza that I'm highlighting here at the end of this poem is really, really important because we have this debate in today's modern world, and it tends to revolve around the scientific understanding of things. And the debate is whether consciousness that we have arises out of who we are as biological beings, or is consciousness the essence of our biological being, and the biological being is a container for consciousness. This is a debate between materialism and spirituality. Now, when Rumi says, this that we are now created the body cell by cell like bees building a honeycomb, he's saying that consciousness is preeminent and that the material world that we inhabit is secondary. And so our biological beings, our bodies, are vehicles for spirit. The human body and the universe grew from this, he says, not this from the universe and the human body, which is what today's scientific materialism teaches. So it's really fascinating to me how deep these poems go and the kind of things they touch upon once you understand the traditions out of which these authors are writing. And the tradition is the two-self system. We have a spiritual self, and we have an organic self, and the spiritual self is preeminent. So you can take any one of these poems, like you say, and work with it for a very, very, very long time and still not reach the end of it.
Mm. There is a kind of stillness that I experienced as I heard you reading that poem that I equate with the way that I feel when I'm in prayer. And I wonder if you would agree that connecting with these poems in this way, with the mystic poets, can lead people into that practice of prayer, which I believe we do naturally do that. It's our natural way, but can maybe lead someone who doesn't have that foundation or the labels or the practices. It's a wonderful way to lead you in naturally to that state of prayer or contemplation.
You know, it really is. And we can stick with this very same poem to sort of look at that question. The beginning of the poem, this we have now is not imagination. This is not grief or joy, not a judging state or an elation or sadness. Now, all of these things that he mentions now and says that this state that we currently occupy is not these things, he's basically saying, this is not the ego at work here. This is something else. He says, this is the presence with a capital P that doesn't come and go. This is what is ultimate. And so he's basically saying here that through spiritual practice, which is what this poem's about, it's about the zikr ceremony, through spiritual practice, you can transcend the ego and come into a place of serene permanence, which is my way of talking about the egoless state where we can touch spirit. And so this poem itself really gives a recipe for the prayer life or the contemplative life of getting empty of ego and touching that which is permanent and serene and abiding.
I'm wondering, Alex, what your daily spiritual practice is. You have all these wonderful things at your fingertips. What is your daily spiritual practice?
Yeah, I actually, I'm tempted with some attention deficit disorder problems in my spiritual practice because I am so enlivened by so much of what's available to us from these masters. But as much as I love the mystic poets and I do teach from them and I use them for my own psychodynamic work, my actual spiritual practice is principally a combination of mantra and silent meditation.
Do you feel that? I'm a big believer, so I'm beating my own drum here. I feel that daily spiritual practice is essential to help us remember who we are. Remembering as part of what I took from that poem is that I am not what attaches to me. I am not the feelings that float by me. I am not the things I buy or the smart things that I'm thinking with my mind, but that I am more and everything and all. And I'm wondering if you feel that daily spiritual practice helps us in this way remember that connection.
It absolutely does. And again, you've just said it beautifully. You know, the ego is a very intense mechanism. And because of the way modern life is structured, the ego has this belief that it needs to be online and functioning at all times. And so every moment of our waking hours, it's looking to recreate itself and take control of the system in order to help us navigate through our days. And if you don't take on a spiritual practice daily or almost daily that reminds you to relax that system because it's not ultimately who you are and it's not something that has the capacity for touching spirit, you've got to take on a practice that relaxes that system so that you can, as you say, remember who you really are and keep open, to some extent, the gateway into spirit so that you can enter it when you need to. And a daily practice is very important for that. You know, I've heard this metaphor many times, and it's a little simplistic, but it's spot on. You know, if you don't go to the gym almost every day and do your exercise, you'll never run the marathon. Well, if you don't do the spiritual practice every day and build that attentional muscle and the capacity for spiritual experience, you're not going to be able to touch that place when you need to. And so I think that spiritual practice every day is really, really important, even if it's only for 10 or 15 minutes. You got to keep that door open.
I agree. And I think, at least in the way that I teach, is that part of the reason we call it practice is because we don't get it right. Right? We keep growing. We keep doing it over and over and over. And we change our practice as we ourselves change. I think it's fine to have ADD in your spiritual practice because there's so much out there. And what it means is that you never have to be limited. You never have to be bored because there's always, always more. That to me is kind of also a metaphor for the way the divine is in our lives. There is always more. We never reach the end.
No, I think that's right, and it is great that we have all this beautiful deep teaching and all of these methodologies available to us. But what I've learned for me is that for me, and everybody's different, it's important for me to stick with the methodology I've discovered works. And, you know, I do other methods, but for my own practice, when I want to, you know, go in and do that psychodynamic work and keep the channel to spirit open, I use the same methodology all the time.
Yes, I can see what you're saying. It would bring a kind of a coherence, and there's something to be said with, because there are dry spells in all prayer lives.
Indeed.
To stick with that, to continue that coherence through the dry spell. What I'm speaking to, I think, is maybe more about people who think, yeah, this daily spiritual practice thing is okay for you guys, but I can't do it. I can't even get through a 30-second TV commercial without drifting off and doing something else. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I can, right, do it. And so I think what I'm speaking to is that idea that there are so many opportunities, so many ways that we're not just, you know, here, take these beads and kneel down in front of the crucifix. This is your spiritual practice and that's it, baby.
Right.
You better get into it or not. There's so much out there available that it's okay to go to what you're drawn to.
Yeah, and I think you got it again because, you know, I wouldn't take somebody who's new to the spiritual life and say to them, you know, I'm going to spend 2 hours on Friday night doing chant and silent meditation. Why don't you sit with me and expect them to be able to do that? It's absurd. So what I do with people like that is I sort of, you know, I lay the panoply of spiritual practices out there, which can be everything from mantra and silent meditation to working with the mystic poets. I mean, it is a spiritual practice to sit down with a poem by Rumi or Hafez, you know, or Rabia or whoever, whatever speaks to you, and sit down and mull these verses over and over and over again and look at the way they speak to your life and journal this and contemplate on this. This is a spiritual practice as well. So there's a vast array of spiritual practices, and I think people should, especially at the beginning, engage whatever methodology speaks to them, because if it doesn't speak to you, you're not going to stay with it.
Yes, and because it is a practice, when you don't stick with it, you take a breath and try again. Right?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, there are days where I sit down on my cushion and bang, I'm in. I'm not even sure how I got in. And there are days where I can sit down on my cushion for 2 hours and never get in the door. Mm-hmm. And I have to remind myself of just what you said. It's a practice. It doesn't always work. You don't always hit the home run, you know.
Yes. Now, I'm watching the clock creep to the top of the hour. Can you share with us your websites, because we haven't even really talked about the Mystic Poet Circle website either. Can you share your websites in the center, all the ways that people can connect with you and your work?
Sure, I can do that. You did mention my Return to the Mystic site. And if people go to the Return to the Mystic site, returntothemystic.org, you'll see along the top there my menu. And on each of my pages, actually, I've got a section called What We Offer. And the pretty similar offerings on each one. Return to the Mystic, you know, I do a monthly lesson on a mystical or contemplative text where I write or talk or do a video, 500 words or 5 minutes. And I have a members forum where I post this, and people have dialogue about it on the members forum. And also once a month, I do a spiritual lesson along the same lines. I do a monthly audio webinar with people. So after they've had a few weeks to digest the lesson on the contemplative text and look at the spiritual lesson, we get together online once a month and we have a conversation about where people are at with it. And with the Mystic Poet Circle, which is actually mysticpoetcircle.com rather than .org, like Return of the Mystic, mysticpoetcircle.com, I do the same kind of thing. I post a mystic poem every so often, every couple of weeks, and we also have a forum where we discuss the mystic poems online, and we also have a monthly webinar where we discuss the poems, and on occasion I'll recite a poem and put up an audio file of it, and once in a while I'll do a video for people to look at, and we just do this work online, and I'm not trying to get rich doing this, I'm trying to make it really affordable for people, so I'm actually doing this for $12 a month. And if people engage at this, I'm also available via email and Skype and Google+ to help people on their spiritual path, because I really do think that the online venue is a fantastic way for delivering lots of information to people about their spiritual journey that they're going to have to work really hard to get otherwise. So the online work is a way of touching base with people and providing a community for people and getting information to people. It's not really a substitute for an in-person community, but if you stick with it and you do it religiously, you actually can develop a sense of spiritual community online. And I'm pretty available to people, so if they want to engage and see how it goes, that would be great.
And that's wonderful. I believe with you that the online community is a wonderful way for... One of the kind of metaphors that people use to talk about spiritual journey is from being alone, being separate, feeling cut off, that journey into the heart of the world. And it is into the heart of the heart of divine love. And that online community, the way we reach out through this radio program, through all the ways we come together with people who we cannot see but know they're there, it's a wonderful metaphor, a powerful way for people to further their own spiritual journey.
And there's a lot of collective wisdom out there. And so in the forums, you know, people can ask questions or comment on my commentary, what have you, and I can give answers. But it's a community, and you never know who's going to have the piece of the puzzle you need. So it's actually access to more than me. It's access to other seekers, which is great.
Alex, thank you so much for being on the program today. Is there a thought you'd like to leave us with?
Oh, I feel like I am just talking you all to death. So I don't know if I have a specific thought to leave you with today. I don't know. If you have 2 minutes, I can share with you my favorite Hafez poem.
I have about 60 seconds.
Oh, I'm not going to be able to do it in that amount of time, so
well,
I'll pass.
That means you'll have to come back. Far from talking us all to death, I think this is, it brings to light a topic that's so important, and I feel like you're exploring it, and in your work you explore it in such an accessible way. I'm really glad you took the time to be on the show. Thank you so much.
Great, and thanks for having me.
That was the Reverend Dr. Alexander Riegel. He is the founder of Return to the Mystic. You can get more information about that at returntothemystic.org, and also founder of the Mystic Poet Circle. There's information about that available to you at mysticpoetcircle.com. Now, if you'd like to share your feedback about this program, you can reach me through my website, karenhager.com. I will be teaching and speaking in San Francisco and Los Angeles over the next few weeks. There's more information about that. If you'd like to see what I look like face-to-face, there's more information about that at karenhager.com. And thank you for listening today. Together, we are spreading a little more light in the world, and a little more light is always a good thing. Until next time, I'm wishing you peace.